consideration this afternoon. State of Philippe A. Radelet, deceased, where we will hear oral argument, but as the presiding judge today, I'm going to take just a moment that won't count against anybody's time, just to take note of something. I noticed that Judge Ferris was going to be arguing today, so since he was on the panel that I argued my first case in front of, I had Clarissa look up the case, Rankin versus Home Savings and Loan Association of Austin, and the argument was on April 9th of 1991 in the old courthouse. Chief Justice Weaver was the presiding judge that day, and Justice Meyer was also on the panel. And I split time with Skip Reynolds, who I was working for at Canny Hanger at the time, and I believe Jeff Springer was the attorney on the other side. And so having Judge Ferris argue in front of me, having begun my appellate practice in front of him, I wanted to take note of that before beginning today, and I appreciated that that hearing, because he treated me fairly, and I will try and return the same today. So,
did you win or lose?
That shall remain that a matter of public record, but I'll leave it at that. So anyway, but welcome. So at this point in time, we will hear oral argument in this case. So you want to call the case, or have I already effectively done so?
I'll call it.
All righty.
The court will now call the state of Philippe Radelet. And may it please the court, Mr. David Ferris,
to argue for the appellant, Mr. Thomas Michelle, to argue for the appellee.
May it please the court.
Your Honor, we have come full cycle. This is very likely my last argument. If not my last, it's just real close.
Real close. Okay.
I'm making plans to retire as quickly as John Lively and circumstances will permit. Your Honors, in this case, we spent an awful lot of time on the limitations defense. This is not a limitations defense issue, as the court knows from reading the briefs, but it is the context in which the court issue is presented to you. The core issue in this case is, did the appellant's misconduct, and I take my clients with warts and all, we don't deny they didn't do things they were supposed to do, but did that misconduct justify a presumption that their limitations defense lacked merit? And the answer, we think, is a really pretty strong no. Judge King, in justifying the presumption that somehow all of the affirmative defenses that we raised on behalf of the appellants were without merit or lacked merit, looked to three things, and those are found on page 15 of the appellee's brief. The judge pointed to the fact that the appellants consistently refused to disclose their actions and financial dealings on behalf of the trusts. They failed to fund the trust, and they failed to and refused to account for all their actions as trustees. Well, let's flip those three things. Let's suppose that the appellants had done the right thing in all of that, and had admitted, for the sake of argument, that perhaps they had taken $10 million worth of trust assets and hid it in an offshore account somewhere. Would that change the ability of the appellee, Lourdes Radelet, to respond to and overcome the problem she has with waiting 18 years after her father died before bringing this lawsuit? And I submit that it would not. So then let us compare this case with the Altisa case, which is cited in the appellant's brief. In Altisa, the Supreme Court concluded that Altisa had knowingly violated a temporary restraining order. That was the violation that the trial court punished with death penalty sanctions. But the Supreme Court also said that nothing about Altice's conduct supported a presumption that its fraud defense lacked merit. The Supreme Court could not tell from the record in that case whether or not whether Altice's fraud defense had merit, but just simply said they pled it, they're entitled to bring it up, and you can't take it away from them because of something they did that's as unrelated as they're violating the temporary restraining order in that case was. In this case, the limitations defense that we have raised from early on in this case, or early on in our firm getting in this case, cannot be in somehow negated by the fact that the appellants did a really shabby job of responding to her discovery requests, and that's what this is all about.
Well, kind of where I'm sort of looking at this right now is that basically y'all have a limitations defense. The question is not that y'all have a limitations defense and a meritorious limitations defense. The question is really whether the other side has a meritorious basis for avoiding the limitations defense, okay? Because there's no doubt as to, you know, although I'm sure we'll have some argument with regard to continuing tort, et cetera, but there's really no doubt as to what the limitations defense is here and when it accrued in terms of the cause of action accrued for purposes of the limitations running. The only real question is whether or not there are a factual or legal basis for avoiding the running of limitations. So in virtually every one of those types of cases, okay, the limitations defense is going to be meritorious in and of itself, all right? The question becomes, trying to apply Altice, is that sufficient to avoid death penalty sanctions, or do we have to look at what your discovery abuse or any of the other things that you're actually not contesting happened have an impact not on your defense but on the avoidance of your defense here?
Well, it doesn't apply because, again, the appellee to overcome our defense, which is, I think, golden, our limitations defense, and in fact, it's the only one we've even argued in the brief, obviously. To overcome it, they've got to come up with a justification that somehow the failure to respond to discovery denies them an opportunity to overcome that burden in this case. I'm not sure I answered your question here.
Well, I'm not sure I completely articulated my question correctly. Sorry. So go ahead.
Are you saying Altice creates a rule that for there to be a death penalty sanction, there has to be a reasonable inference that the sanctionable conduct indicates that the defense is not valid?
I think Transamerica creates that rule, Your Honor. And Transamerica is the case that all these cases cite, and
that brings me back to my question, which is in limitations cases, virtually all the limitations cases, the limitations defense itself is going to be meritorious all by itself. The real question is going to be, can the limitations be avoided? Okay, so are you arguing that in limitations cases such as this, you can't give a death penalty sanction because the defense is going to be meritorious on its face? The only question is whether it can be avoided.
Well, I can certainly imagine cases where a limitations defense was raised and it should be disregarded, but it's probably because there was a repeated tort. Doesn't apply in this case. If you look at that, not only the things that we raised, but the affidavit of the appellee, Lourdes Rodelette, and if you look at her pleadings, she's complaining of stuff that happened 18 years before this lawsuit was ever filed, or minimally 8 years before this lawsuit was ever filed. And during that period of time, there was this continuous conduct by Anna, her mother, who always took the position and does still, in her mind, I'm afraid, that everything went to her. So yes, limitations wasn't told by anything. So the question then is, well, can you be just so bad in some other area of the trial, like discovery of assets that might be recoverable, to justify denying you your hearing or on your limitations?
Well, then let's go a little bit further then. Okay, so the discovery is asking for assets. Okay, and whether or not those assets were disclosed, or how the disposition of those assets were appropriately disclosed. Why is that not discovery that goes to the avoidance of the limitations defense as to when the daughter knew or should have known that particular asset was being disposed of in an improper way? Why does the fact that discovery was not forthcoming not create a presumption that, in fact, the avoidance defense would be the avoidance of the limitations defense would be appropriate if, in fact, y'all had presented and produced the discovery that was requested?
Because the discovery that was not produced would not, had it been provided in any imaginable form, have given Lourdes Radelat a reason to get out from under the limitations burden she has of waiting 18 years. Now, there could be a case, and I'm struggling to think of an example, but I'm sure there are, that where had Anna and Andrew failed to disclose some information that would defeat their limitations defense, or that we could see that the Lourdes had requested that sort of information, Anna and Andrew didn't provide it, or indeed perhaps destroyed it, then the presumption would be, you know what? That sounds like you must not have had merit for your defense, otherwise you would have been forthcoming with this. But that isn't this case. And I think that if we follow both Transamerica, the Supreme Court opinion in Transamerica, and then the Altesa case, and I think I may like your pronunciation better than mine, Your Honor, then I think we're correct in saying they can't get there, that it was an abuse of discretion for the court, under those circumstances, under the facts of this case, to deny them an opportunity to be heard on their defenses.
Are you moved for summary judgment on the limitation of defense? Judge King denied it.
Right.
Okay. Denial of a motion for summary judgment is not usually subject to appeal. But it does seem like you're kind of arguing that on the merits of the limitations defense, that the evidence conclusively establishes the merits of the limitations defense, and therefore the death penalty sanction should not be available under the circumstances? Or does it matter whether you establish conclusively the affirmative defense, or just that there is some evidence of a meritorious defense?
Well, I think it's sufficient that there's some evidence. And if you look, that's exactly what occurred in Altesa. In fact, I don't know if there was any evidence at all. The Supreme Court opinion in that case, and it's a per curiam opinion, The court said, well, we don't know how good that defense of fraud, it was a fraud and fraudulent conveyance, for a fraudulent inducement, I think it was, defenses that Altesa raised. And they said, we don't know if they're any good or not, but you raised them and you get to be heard on them. And the fact that you didn't provide this, that you violated a restraining order by stealing customers away from the plaintiff, you know that's wrongful, but that doesn't justify denying you an opportunity to be heard on your defense, which is not related to that. Same thing in this case. That
so you're arguing that under Transamerica,
this would have to be remanded. No, I'm not arguing the court should.
Right. You haven't asked for anything other than reversal and remand. Understood.
That's right. This one will have to go back to the trial court, Your Honor.
Okay. But you're arguing that death penalty sanctions have an element to it based upon Transamerican that specifically is there has to be something about the sanctionable conduct that gives rise to a presumption that the affirmative defense is without merit. That has to be shown.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct. I believe that was actually the holding in Transamerica, but clarified perhaps or expanded a little more in Altesa.
Okay. And you're not contesting the actual factual findings of the court with regard to the actual misconduct here. I don't see that in here, that you're not saying that his order of contempt was improper or in error or anything of that nature. Okay. You're just flat saying that nothing that he found was in any way, shape, or form related to the affirmative defense of limitations. Therefore, it was improper for him to strike the pleadings and award death penalty sanctions.
That's correct.
Okay.
Let me ask you one additional question. The $1,145,000 that's in the judgment, was that derived from a motion for summary judgment? How was that figure calculated?
I honestly don't recall. You know, this case went on for several years. And I don't remember, but the effect of the thing was to give not only all the remaining assets of the that would be perhaps trust property to the appellee, but also gave her damages and attorney's fees on top of that, and that in a way is somewhat similar to the Altesa case, but it's an Altesa case. Not only did the trial court dismiss the pleadings of the defendant, but it went way over the top with the award of damages.
Well, didn't the Supreme Court refer to that as more than death penalty sanctions?
They did. They did, exactly, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please the court.
Sure.
If I may also come a little bit full circle, Justice Ferris was on the Court of Appeals when I was the law clerk or briefing attorney for Chief Justice Weaver at the time.
It's the same in 91?
In 90.
In 90, oh.
Cool. In 91, so you might have.
You may have been sitting off to the side. There was something specific that happened during that oral argument that I really can't go into, but it was very memorable in that regard, which at some point in time we can talk about, see if you remember it.
Yes,
but
Your Honor.
Anyway.
May it please the court.
Sure.
Justice Basil, if I may answer your question, it was on a final trial where the court conducted a trial on the element of damages.
Okay.
There were expert witnesses, unobjected to, expert reports, expert damages, and Mr. Fakutis testified as to attorney's fees. Secondly, there are three unappealed orders granting summary judgment on liability as well. So those are unchallenged as well. So what I think appellants are asking is quite a broad, overly broad reading of Transamerica and Altice to hold that regardless of the conduct. And I think this is a good case to draw an example. Because as we hear, I do not believe it's Transamerica or Altice. Altice was a single violation of an injunction. Here, the unchallenged findings, and I quote from page 6 of Judge King's order, which summarizes the previous 5 pages of sanctionable conduct, which is not attacked in any way, shape, or form. No justification is really given. False affidavits. Manufacturing of false evidence, false affidavits, which are conceded to be false affidavits. In essence, defendants took over the trust assets and sold those assets, converting the proceeds from the properties to their own use, failing to fund the trust as required by the decedent's will, and then refusing to acknowledge the authority of this court to require their compliance with the laws regulating the actions of the fiduciaries in Texas courts. Not only has the court considered the imposition of lesser sanctions, but has in fact imposed lesser sanctions on no less than 8 separate occasions. So the court is faced with a situation, and I'm not conceding that they're not tied, but can a litigant come into a court and basically abuse the judicial process in every way possible by submitting admittedly false evidence? Frank Newman has to come into court and testify that, yes, Anna understands English perfectly and that she's competent, and that then Judge King orders an independent medical examination that finds she's competent, refuse to respond to discovery, refuse to take depositions, violate court orders and court injunctions. If you're going to talk the first bite of it, is that a presumption? I think it certainly is. I don't think this court wants to go so far to say, regardless of the litigant's conduct, and I don't think the Supreme Court has held that in either one of the cases, that regardless of the litigant's conduct, no matter how severe and how egregious, and how many times he's given them, the judge has given them the opportunity to try to cure and correct that behavior, that literally a litigant can ignore every court order, every rule, and every conduct and say, there ain't anything you can do about it. That's their argument. Because they don't attack a single finding on the contemptuous violations of Texas law.
Well, what are we to do? What do we make of the constructive notice argument based on Evans that basically the second the trust is created, okay, the testamentary trust is created, and your client is created a co-trustee with her mother and brother, okay, does the record reflect she never got actual notice from the court? Because it's the court that created the trust, not the attorneys for mom and brother. Okay, it was the court that created the trust. She never got actual notice or even constructive notice of the fact that she was a co-trustee over a trust that's actually, because a few of those on the trial bench, you know, you're writing out who's going to be the trustees, et cetera, and you sign it, you're expecting that judgment creating the trust is going to go to the people who actually are supposed to effectuate the trust.
You would, and to point out just a little bit, it's not the court who really creates the trust. It's a pour-over will that then goes into the trust, and the trust is created by the document. What happens, and they characterize this...
But the court's action is necessary to effectuate all of that in terms of a judgment, is it not?
Well, I'm not so sure about that, because when you get into probate law, you're getting what you're doing, you're applying and asking for the court to admit the will to probate. Then the will is admitted to probate. But after that point, the will is admitted to probate. After that, it's a trust instrument with trust duties and trust obligations. So the people who are actually taking the actions have a fiduciary obligation to notify and keep informed. We're doing this right now. I just sent out 10 letters to third generation contingent beneficiaries letting them know about a trust, because that's we're fulfilling our trustees' obligations to notify of all of our actions, all of our rights, much to my chagrin, because we're afraid what's going to happen when it comes back.
Does the will state that Ms. Lords, as I
yes,
is to be a co-trustee of the trust?
It does.
And does that not arise to an irrebuttable presumption of notice?
I let me put it this way: a couple things. One, with regard to the trustee status, I don't think it's an irrebuttable presumption, because it's not technically still, as some of the cases have held, regarding the will. However, let's assume that there is some notice that she's been appointed as a co-trustee. That's different than actual conduct regarding a trust. And so let's say she had notice that she was a co-trustee, but then no actions are taken. And there's evidence inside this record that the mother said everything was going to be fine and everything was going to be taken.
So if no action is taken, shouldn't that be some clue to her that something should be going on?
Yeah, she thought everything perfectly fine was going on. However, but as things are going stated fine, in the meantime, they're absconding with all of the trust property. Now, this is trust property, and these are fiduciary obligations. This inquiry started early on in August of 2012 with a request for an accounting. There's no limitations. There's no limitations on an accounting. That is a mandatory obligation that must happen when requested. So that is not going to be barred by limitations at all.
Okay. So basically, my understanding of it is the devisement was to two trusts, up to $600,000. There were no separate property devisements other than everything going into one of the two trusts. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Up to $600,000, which is, of course, the limit with regard to estate taxes, federal estate taxes, that went into one trust. Everything else that was in the estate went over into the family trust. Okay?
Right.
Correct?
For tax planning estate at the time.
To admit the will to probate, the court had to name someone as the independent executor.
Correct.
And mother is identified. Was she in fact named independent executor?
Yes.
Okay. So she actually wears two hats here.
Right.
She's wearing the hat of independent executor, who has a fiduciary duty to make sure that the will is appropriately facilitated and executed, because she's the executor.
Correct.
But she also has a second hat here, which is she's a co-trustee. And as far as I can tell from the record, she's equal to the son and the daughter with regard to the two trusts. But there's some degree of, if you will, I know this is a loaded term, but some degree of self-dealing here, because she's responsible for handing over to herself and to the other two co-trustees.
Correct.
The assets.
And plus she has her own half of the community estate that is hers. So she's in control of the property as it being half of her community.
She's got remainder interests in
her
all
own,
of
he
it.
Can only,
right.
He can only devise
his part of the estate.
Part of it. And so the issues that gave rise here are not just from the estate side, it's on the trustee side. So if she takes an action, not disclosing it to anyone, of taking property of trust, personal property and real property, and taking these actions outside the court's purview. We're not under the independent executor. She's acting as a trustee, taking these properties along with her son. There's no notice, there's no disclosure, and representations, everything's going to be okay. Now,
what you're essentially arguing is that the lack of notice that you're saying, and the reason why the presumption Justice Wallach's talking about doesn't apply here, is not because of her status as a co-trustee, it's her status as an independent executor. She never actually told the daughter about the trusteeship in terms of effectuating the two trusts.
Yeah, she never disclosed any of their actions in either of their capacities, in either of her capacities, when they took property and they are a fiduciary and she's actually exercising control of that property. Those are fiduciary duties.
Fiduciary duty from who to who?
From her, the mother, and the son to co-beneficiaries and trustees.
A trustee owes a fiduciary duty to a fellow trustee?
Perhaps.
Perhaps. Is there any authority to that?
I'm not sure about that.
The fiduciary duty to the trust.
Oh, absolutely.
And the fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries of the trust.
Absolutely.
And all three co-trustees also happen to be beneficiaries of the trust.
Correct.
But again, as an independent executor, she owed a different fiduciary duty than she would have as a co-trustee.
Absolutely.
Okay.
She would have dual obligations.
Is that reflected in the evidence and in the record that was presented here? Are we still arguing about fiduciary duties between co-trustees?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's in the record that she had these obligations to fulfill these items both as a trustee and as an independent executor. Either way, to disclose her actions, especially, you know, in an independent administration, you report and do it a final accounting. But with regards to a trustee, where these actions are taken years later, and no disclosure of disposition of trust property, to me that is classic, going to be classic factual determinations on limitations issues. And they want to try to say that the factual allegations here are reasons why we rebut this presumption. If the court wants to read it broadly, that a person can come in and do any conduct whatsoever and be absolved of it and say, I can't strike my pleadings, I don't care what it is.
So how did the discovery request that went unanswered or insufficiently answered, and which were the subject of the previous sanctions, how did those relate to the issues that you're talking about?
Very minimally, if you're going to require a direct correlation between the wrongful conduct and the alleged offense, and I submit to this court, it's not that, it's got to be that 100 direct. It's, we're talking about in Altice, it's one violation, and then there was a death penalty sanction of striking here.
Let me ask you, has the Supreme Court, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Go ahead and make sure you finish this.
Secondly, then, yes. Mr. Bakudis repeatedly was trying to obtain information, which we still don't have today, is what and when were those some of those properties disposed of, to give us notice of when those actions might have occurred, which would have gone right to the defense. But we don't know. Mr. Bakudis made it in his closing argument in the motions for sanctions, also at the final trial, is we don't know. It's a little bit trying to prove a negative here on a record on which there really wasn't a full-fledged fight on the discovery, but in that respect, Mr. Bakudis was pounding the table asking for this information, and to say there's a presumption, I think we know why they were resisting.
And what I'm asking for, I don't think it's necessarily direct relationship, but there has to be some connection, some nexus between the discovery that they didn't answer and the avoidance that you're trying to raise. And so I'm just kind of trying to get you to focus, help us focus on what that nexus is.
I think that is part of it. I'm going to go the most narrow way possible. That nexus is going to be hiding the discovery and the actual transactions that would go to the actual limitations defense. Broadening it out, I keep saying it's just discovery. It is not just discovery that was violated here. It was court orders being held in contempt and 8 lesser sanctions being imposed.
So what's the nexus between that activity and the limitations avoidance?
I think it's all deny, deny, deny. It all goes to we're not going to tell you anything. We're not going to be compelled to tell you anything about the actual transactions, what they happened, or whether that property's still here. For notice's purpose. Now, they cite that the discovery rule doesn't apply in some estate cases, but they don't address at all of the trustee's obligation. That the discovery rule, the fraudulent concealment, all of that discovery, all that evidence would go to directly address those alleged, as Justice Birdwell says, defense. Anybody can raise a limitations defense, right? And then we have to say, oh, that could be a good defense. However, as you engage in this conduct and you have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to get through this mess, the court would be encouraging this type of conduct and say, I'm going to beg you bear the burden of $150,000 in attorney's fees when somebody doesn't show up for court hearings, they submit false evidence, they lie to the court, they don't respond to discovery, and they commit contemptuous acts in front of the court.
Well, I will ask you my question.
Yeah, but yes.
Do you think the Supreme Court's ever held as broadly as you suggested at first that the conduct can become so obstructive that a death penalty sanctions can be imposed even though you can't draw a presumption that the conduct indicates that the defense is meritless?
I'm not exactly aware. I don't know that we've cited anything that directly on point. I will certainly go back with that refined, narrowing look, but I am not aware of any case. Transamerica and Altice doesn't say, oh, it has, you know. Altice, if you read it, it talks about lesser imposed sanctions. It talks about all the Transamerica factors. And then what they finally get to is that there's this one violation of a temporary restraining order, and the judge then struck the death penalty sanctions. I think we all understand that. That falls within, I think, classic Transamerica. And they were saying, I think it's more of a factor than a complete broad brush rule that you can commit horrendous acts and say because you don't draw that it's not going directly to one of my affirmative defenses, you can't strike it. I'm not aware of any case that says that.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Would you add 3 minutes to Judge Ferris's time, please?
Your Honors, I'd like to address a couple of facts which I think may not be completely understood. First of all, it's true that my clients failed to show up for depositions. That was before I was brought in to try the lawsuit. They both were deposed. As my recollection is that Anna's deposition, she appeared for 3 days of deposition, Andrew for 1 day. There were discovery responses. They weren't complete. There were supplements to the discovery responses. They're not complete. It was a struggle. Third thing is that not only is there constructive notice in this case, but there's actual notice. Lourdes joined her mother a year after her father's death in a Med-Mal case in which she complained of a discovery request by the defendant in that case, saying, go look at the probate records. My father's will's on file in the probate record here in Tarrant County. The result of this case is unjust, and it's inconsistent with the testamentary testimony intent of the deceased. I really think that's it, unless the court has more questions for me.
Any questions?
No, sir.
Nope.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank y'all. Case is submitted. Thank y'all for your arguments. And the case will be submitted, and we'll get back with you soon.